Tell me about Cathy. She has written to me that all is well, that Martha remains proud of her papa and makes pictures of me each night. But what is the truth, papa? Are they well? Cathy almost shut the journal then. The temptation to cast it across the room was almost insurmountable. You'd have known if only you'd asked, she whispered, and her vitriol showed itself in spittle showered across the page. Wherever Caspar was now, perhaps the ink in his own journal was smearing just as the ink in this. On the next page, Papa Jack had written, for the first time, back to his son. My Caspar, how good it feels to see your words. The emporium continues, as you can imagine, with long days and nights, empty of everything but the invention. I will keep my promise, my boy, and say nothing of our communications to Cathy and Martha. Yet perhaps you do them little credit, for they are thinking of you and know you too well to believe in the fairy tales you send. Your patchwork dog whimpers at your bedside at night, but Martha and Cathy are keeping it warm. Sometimes the missives came in a flurry. Other times there were weeks between each, and Papa Jack filled the silences with quiet reports of interludes at the Emporium. As Papa Jack wrote of the patchwork spider he was planning, Caspar found himself marching the flat lowlands of the Belgian border, those farms and coppices of ancient Flanders. It is a challenge to reach the sea, he declared, with the glee of one boy defying another to beat him in a race, and by this many battles will be saved. Cathy's breathing stilled as she read the next pages, for Caspar had not yet reached Ypres, not without seeing his very first battle. Those same farms and coverts that he had described so gaily, that was where he had first fired a gun. And it was not nearly as I had thought, Papa, was all that he wrote. Yet now we have reached Ypres. Through the darkness we can hear them in the fields, but the town is ours, and it is here I shall spend my opening night. The next letter described the division at rest as winter approached. Ypres was a welcome distraction from the camps and barns they had barracked in on the march. There were beds and soft linen and, Cathy winced, French girls in the beer halls at night. There was food as well, better food than the tins and dried army rations on which they had marched. Not Mrs. Horning's emporium fare, that much was true, but delectable all the same. Papa, read the following page, first frost across Ypres. What magic's on opening night? And beneath that, in Papa Jack's own hand, alas, no first frost across the emporium roofs. You are not so very far away, my son, but winter keeps its own pace. Be safe and be warm. She had startled at the thought of Caspar seeing battle, but it was the idea that for the first time Caspar had known a different first frost to the emporium that made Cathy soften toward him. She looked at the date Caspar had scrawled at the top of this missive. 2 weeks had passed since that date, and she pictured him standing on the ramparts. Did they have ramparts in Ypres? And gazing out over Flanders fields, bejewelled in white. How homesick he must have felt, even with the shop hands around him. All the same, the next pages revealed Caspar content with his lot. He professed his fears for Cathy and Martha often, but of Ypres and the villages behind the front where the division made its barracks, he spoke in glowing terms. I am making us toy soldiers, Papa, little trinkets to sit in our barracks or carry with us on patrols. Nightly we must walk them, and a man can feel awfully alone, marching in file through farms and forest he does not know. A toy soldier in a pocket can be great comfort. It tells us we are part of a tribe. I wonder, Papa, about the years you spent in the frozen East, and what your toy soldiers meant to you. He spoke, too, of the days spent digging the line, reshaping the land. Robert Kesey had struck up a romance with a local girl. They had no language in common, but Kesey delighted her with a patchwork mouse he had secreted in his packs. 2 days after the first frost in Flanders came a declaration from Papa Jack. This year we have a new friend to work the shop floor. Perhaps you will not remember Wolfram Siskind, who until this summer worked his chocolatiers in a little Bond Street mews. But I can assure you, your 10-year-old self thought his shop an extravaganza to set our emporium to shame. You will recall the scenes outside the German embassy, how they threw rocks and lay the little red door to siege. I am afraid Wolfram suffered a similar fate, and since the summer his shop has been lain to waste too many times. So for this winter only, he will sell his concoctions of chocolate and honey and spun sugar from a grotto here on our own shop floor. The truth is, Wolfram has struggled in his work for some time. He is an artiste in his chosen form, but across time his spun sugar mice, his chocolate hawks, his bears sculpted from toffee and nuts have grown so that they feel too real, and not even the most merciless child could bring themselves to eat them. Instead, they take them home and make them beds from cotton wool, or keep them in their dolls' houses as toys. For Wolfram, it is a triumph, but one suspects his creditors take a different approach. Whatever we can do to help him, we will. You would find him a man after your own heart. Your loving Papa. The next page was filled with a scrawl so fierce that Cathy was taken aback. There was violence in that hand. Beneath it there had once been words, but Caspar had scoured them out so deeply not even their impressions remained, only a spiralling chaos of black ink. On the next page, the words could be read, but the hand still unsteady. On patrol this night, Robert Kesey dropped dead by my side. His body will be laid to rest come the dawn. We returned fire into the pitch of night, and Papa, I have killed my first men. Do not tell me a German could ever be after my own heart. To which Papa Jack had simply replied, never forget. Once upon a time, those men played with toys too. And it put Caspar Godman to such shame that he had not written since. Not even when his father begged and begged and begged. It was late when Cathy closed the journal. The clock on the wall, with its manifold faces, told her it was after 3. Frost had grown in fractures across the window glass, winter starting to harden. It would at least bring custom to the shop floor. She ventured out and into the rest of the Godmans' quarters. In the workshop the fire had burnt down to embers, and Papa Jack was asleep in his chair. It was so rare that he retired to his bed, not in these long months of winter. She was about to replace the journal on his lap, when his inkpot and pen caught her eye. And damn it, why shouldn't she? She was his wife! She picked up the quill and pressed it to the page. Caspar, she wrote, I know. Beneath it she signed her name. Then, because her anger had faded with the night, she forced in the words, my love, cramped up so that he might still think it an afterthought. In her dreams that night were patchwork dogs and razor wire. Caspar Godman had a contraption in his back, and Robert Kesey had to wind it up so that Caspar could march. She woke in a cold sweat, and another emporium day began. The gall of the white feather was nothing compared to the gall Emile felt on seeing its giver again. And yet, the next day, as he stood godlike over more battles of the long war, there she was, watching him from an alcove between the aisles. It was most distracting. It had taken only a day for the rumours of the new long war game to spread across the schoolyards of London town. Boys had dragged their mothers to the emporium directly after their school days finished. Others, Emile knew, would be planning trips from Gloucester and Cirencester, Edinburgh and all the Yorkshire wolds, pilgrimages from far and wide, all to see his soldiers, and there she was, like a ghost at his feast. One boy had tugged on his hand and told him how he wanted a troop of soldiers just like my daddy. And this had given Emil the biggest thrill of his life. When Emil could stand it no more, he stepped from his pedestal, called the boys battling away to a parley, and told them he would be back soon. For a time it was enough not to be in her line of sight. He worked at the register, wrapping presents, and in the work found his composure. Except, when he looked up, there she was again, lined up in the queue with all the other shoppers. By the time she got to the front, the blood was roiling in his veins. "Hello," she ventured. "Sir?" There was only so long Emil could keep his head down. "You haven't asked me my name," Emil snapped. "I'm aware of it. I hadn't planned to. I'd planned to order you out of my emporium, but we don't turn a soul away. It's one of our dictums."
"Dictums," she said with a smile. "Emil Godman, you have the quaintest turn of phrase."
This only infuriated him more. He had so few words. "As a matter of fact, I've come to tender an apology. I have a cousin on the board. I verified your record. You're no coward, Emil Godman."
This caught Emil almost wholly off guard. He fumbled with wrapping paper, tied his hands to a box of the long wall with ribbon.
"My name is Nina Dean. I'm afraid I was too eager. I would like to make restitution."
"Restitution," thought Emil. "You have such a formal turn of phrase."
"What kind of restitution?"
"I was thinking of a home-cooked dinner, from one supporter of king and country to another."
"If you hadn't guessed, this is my busiest time of year. A home-cooked dinner, indeed."
Emil snorted, imitating disgust. Yet even now he was thinking of roast potatoes on a plate, gravy thick with dripping bread and butter and...
"Then I might cook for you here. I think Mrs. Horner might have a moment at the thought of a stranger rifling in her larder."
Miss Nina Dean returned Emil's snort, turned on her heel and marched away. Still flushing red, Emil returned to his wrapping. Only now did he realize how his heart was pounding. He was glad she was gone. He was sorry she was gone. And the two were curdling in the most unholy grumble in his stomach.
A shadow fell across him. "Yes?" he snapped, and on looking up saw that it was none other than Miss Nina Dean, her arms laden down with dozens of boxes of soldiers. She deposited them on the counter with a crash.
"I shall take them all, these and 100 more. My aunts and I shall deliver them to the boys' homes. For they're bound to swell this year when fathers stop coming home. And I shall want 12 boxes of ballerinas as well. Dainty ones, who can spin en pointe and hold perfect arabesques. And then, after you're done with your wrapping, done with your harumphing and general discontent, then you can accept my apology, consent for me to cook for you, and look me in the eye."
Emil's gaze shot up. His whole body was quaking.
"Does that sound like a thing you might do for me?"
And Emil said, "Yes. Yes, I suppose it does."
"My papa is a scoundrel," wrote Caspar. "I had sworn him to secrecy and took it as a pledge. But there you are, dear Cathy, dancing across the page. As fortune had it, I was awake and staring at the page as the words appeared. I followed you with every etch of the pen, and I know you were angry, Cathy. It was there in the rush of ink. So first of all, let me say now how sorry I am. I wanted to spin you a yarn, a tale of adventure, but that is not what life is, and I should have known that from the first. So now that you are here, every unvarnished thing." She could not remain bitter, not for long. Bitterness was a kind of privilege afforded to those in better times, And how could she be bitter when at least he was still alive, and Robert Kesey cold in the ground? I have missed you, Caspar. That is all. And I want nothing but the truth. I want to know you. The truth. And nothing but the truth. The truth, Mrs. Godman. But my truth is dull these past days. We are sent down and behind the line, leaving others in the 7th to their patrols. To be a soldier, it appears, one must stomach long bouts of nothings and short bursts of everything in the world. Tell me news of the Emporium, Kathy. Tell me something I can tell the boys. We have already missed opening night. So much to tell, thought Kathy, but where to begin? She watched as Caspar's words materialized and thought, he needs some levity, he needs some hope. And what better hope than this? Emile, she wrote, and hesitated on the word, is falling in love. It was the dawn of December, 2 weeks since she invaded the Emporium kitchens to make good her apology to Emile, and Kathy thought she had seen Miss Nina Dean every day since. If she was not there when the doors first opened to wish Emile a good day, she was there in the afternoon, on her hands and knees in the long ward glade, first learning the rules of the game and then directing others. On the 2nd of the month, when London hunkered under its first real snowfall of the season, Kathy gazed out from one of the galleries and saw her leading one army, a gaggle of boys around her, while Emile led the opposing force. Emile's cries of celebration at routing one of her units flurried up into the Emporium dome. I haven't seen him as elated, not even when he used to play with Caspar. Mrs. Horning was at her side, her face screwed up in concentration. Do you trust her? The question gave Kathy pause. At first I was uncertain, she wrote to Caspar that night. To waltz in here as she did and call Emile a coward, right there in front of his customers, well, that is a slight from which it must be hard to recover. And yet, recover from it he has. It helps that she is forthright. It helps that she brooks no nonsense. It helps that she is more sure of herself than almost any other lady I have met. In truth, she can see more like mother to Emile than she does admirer. Her affiliation with the Order of the White Feather, Emile explains, was at the insistence of her aunts, that coven who marched in here on opening night and witnessed Emile's humiliation. When quizzed upon it, Emile insists that it took more courage to return to the Emporium and make amends than it did to come in with an accusing finger. And on that he is correct. And yet Mrs. Hornung's words have stayed with me today, and they linger still. Miss Nina Dean has a cold exterior, but sometimes the light shines through. Certainly, had she no genuine affection for Emile, she would not have spent a day on her hands and knees battling with toy soldiers. It cannot be her interest, so she must do it solely for him. And when I catch myself asking why, I must stop and scold myself. For why shouldn't a woman look at Emile and feel the same things I first felt that summer you helped me stow away in the Wendy House walls? Do I think so little of Emile to deny him even that? What kind of a friend, of a sister, would that make me? So yes, I do trust Miss Nina Dean. I choose to trust her, because Emile chooses to trust her. That should be enough. In the morning, when she checked the journal again, Caspar had made just 3 exclamation marks, and in his next missive told her of the moment he broke the news to the Emporium boys. First they roared with surprise, and then they roared with delight. Please convey our best wishes to my brother and tell him, if there is no band on her finger, nor new children to roam our Emporium halls by the time the peace has arrived, he must forfeit his birthright and cede me every last isle. They wrote more sporadically as Christmas approached. Perhaps Caspar's days were too exhausting, for Kathy's certainly were. The new shop hands, inexperienced as they were, ran her ragged, and when she sank into bed at the end of each night, it was all she could do to write the words, "I love you," in the journal, then fall asleep with its pages pressed up against her face. The snowdrops came late on the Emporium Terrace that year, January already gone by the time the shoots opened up into perfect white jewels. Emil, who held them in the palm of his hand, stepped back through the plate glass doors, crossed the Godman's quarters and went out onto the gallery beyond. Every season ended with this same plummeting feeling in the pit of Emil's stomach. But this year it was more terrible than most, for there, in the glade of the Long War, this Nina Dean was laying out soldiers for a battle of epic proportions, and boys and girls, Miss Nina Dean was drawing more and more girls into the glade, were choosing sides. He lifted the Imperial Capitan out of his pocket and set him to marching on the balcony rail. "I'll have to talk to you," he said. "There isn't anyone else." The Imperial Capitan lifted his arm as if in salute. "If she goes away now, she might not come back next winter. It'll be off to society and those harridan aunts of hers, and next year, who's to say she'll even think of our Emporium at all?" "So what are you waiting for?" he thought, unable to voice it even to the Imperial Capitan. Down below, Miss Nina Dean had started up the battle. She shrieked with glee that soared up and reached Emil even standing so high above. He could, he supposed, march down there right now and say, "I should like it if you were to stay. We need help this year more than any, and you have already proven yourself so adept." His eyes revolved to find the Wendy house, where it still sat between the paper trees. He could see its steepled roof between the branches. Only Caspar knew how the branches sprouted fresh leaves each summer. But in winter they were skeletal as trees in the wild, revealing the Wendy house beneath. Caspar had never got much further in learning how their father stretched out the space inside. That summer his toy boxes were abandoned, because he had a baby to care for, and babies eclipsed everything else, even toys. But the Wendy house remained the most magical of all places on the shop floor. Not just, Emil thought, for the way it staggered and amazed when you stooped through its door. There was a different sort of magic attached to the Wendy house now. One from which no one could escape. What a perfect story. Caspar and Kathy and the Wendy house where they used to live. Sometimes thinking of her just spirited her into being, and as if by magic Kathy appeared far below. On seeing her, Emil had to tighten his hold on the balcony rail. He tried to force himself to look back into the glade, but his eyes, such treacherous things, kept drifting back to Kathy. He remembered visiting her in that Wendy house as well. The books he had read when he thought he might be the only one holding her hand as she... His knuckles whitened. He thought he heard the Imperial Capitan cry out, "Stop being a fool, Emil!" But it was only the sound of his own conscience, drumming against his skull, trying to get out. Because... What do you really think is going to happen, Emil? That this winter you rule the Emporium floor, she'll see what she didn't back then? That she'll come knocking late at night and tell you she was wrong, that it should have been you to help her push Martha out into the world, you to curl around her in bed at night, you to take her hand and marry her down there in the paper trees? Or... And he hated himself even as he thought it. Are you really thinking, what if he didn't come home? What if Caspar stays out there, just like Robert Kesey? And she needs you, needs somebody, but it just happens to be you, to fill the place where he used to lie. A faux Caspar, a shadow, something to cling on to, something to fill the void. Is that really what you think?
She wouldn't even have to change her name.
It was an effort, but he stared at Nina until he was certain Kathy had passed from sight.
And he realized, then, what he had never realized before. This jealousy had started out for Kathy, but the feeling had blossomed and changed. He was jealous of it all now, of Casper being a father, of the games he played with Martha, of... I have never had a mama, thought Emil, but I've always wanted to be a father. Even as a boy, I would think of one day having boys of my own, and playing with them on the carpets as my papa played with me. So, yes, he thought. Perhaps there is a different way of looking at life. And, in the same moment he thought that, Miss Nina Dean looked up from the shop floor. She had the look of a sculpture, and she had caught his eye.
The Emporium, Kathy wrote, is closed for another winter. But there remains great excitement. Emil is to be married. Perhaps you are not surprised, given all the stories I have brought to you, but to us in the Emporium it remains a great shock. On the day the snowdrops flowered, Emil cornered me in the storerooms and, can you believe this, asked my permission. I believe it was only his nerves manifesting. Dear sweet Emil, we'll never conquer those nerves. He needed my emboldening to give him courage and, duly bolstered, he arrested Miss Dean before she left by the Emporium doors and led her to the gallery above the Emporium dome. Then, at his signal, Mrs. Hornung, who was in place in the aisles below, pulled a cord that wound up 100 soldiers at once. High above, Nina saw them march out, and there, according to Emil's design, what geometries it must have taken to make it happen, they wound to a halt in such a way to spell out his proposal. Will you marry me? In letters across the Emporium floor. I am pleased to say that Nina wept openly there and then. Through her tears, she agreed to be Emil's wife. There is a secret history to this. Nina's brother, Emil tells us, perished at the defence of Muscat. Their grandfather has interests in Arabia, and had been tutoring his grandson there when hostilities were declared. He served bravely as an officer, at only 21 years of age, and lost his life in that service. The tragedy has hardened Nina to what she wants from life. This, she now knows, is our brother Emil. She has spent the last weeks in cleverly disguised misery that the end of the season might be the end of their relations. Now she will stay with us all summer long, and be welcome to our Emporium Famille. Kathy sent the dispatch expecting a reply as soon as Casper opened the journal, but by fall of night none had come. She lost herself that morning in joining Martha for her lessons. Then, in the afternoon, they threw themselves into the brave task of accounting for the winter's takings before the man from Lloyd's arrived for his annual account. When no reply had come by fall of next night, the fear she had been holding at bay finally broke through. Now she stood on the threshold of Papa Jack's workshop, wondering whether she dared venture in, if what she was about to say might tear apart his world. At last she found her courage, marched into the workshop, and there Papa Jack slept, his phoenix on his shoulder, Sirius curled up at his feet. He looked so like Casper when he slept, and something in the image soothed her. She slunk back to her quarters alone, looked in on Martha as she too slept, and lay back in the marital bed. In the morning, letters reeled across the journal page. Kathy, please forgive my silence. I am delighted for my brother and wish to fill these pages only with good tidings and salutations for Emil's future wife. I know I will find my home much changed when I return to you, but I can keep the truth from you no longer. I am writing to you from the base hospital at Arras, behind the line. But, Kathy, I am alive. It was the way Casper's hand had trembled upon writing that final line, causing the letters to tumble uncontrolled across the page, that stopped Kathy's heart. She sat upright, raced to read on. By the time the snowdrops had flowered on the Emporium Terrace, Private Caspar Godman had become Lance Corporal, with the Emporium shophands and a group of other men under his command. Spring had brought with it the thaw that closed the Emporium doors, and it was this same thaw that returned Flanders to open war. Cathy, they came for us. We had long thought it was coming and waited each night for the horns to sound. But when it finally happened, they did not send men. They sent great reefs of gas, ghosts, to do their bidding. When men set their minds to it, they accomplished the most terrible things. Caspar had not been on the line on the day the gas first came, but he had watched from behind as the French soldiers staggered through. Some had run, cascading out of the little hamlets they had taken oaths to defend. Others, too trusting or too defiant to understand, had stood their ground. But battle could not be fought against an enemy invisible to the eye, and hundreds had perished there, amid the budding leaves of spring, before any had understood what was happening. Caspar had watched the ambulance wagons flowing like a line of ants into the west. And I wondered, Cathy, how many men made it to their beds, or how many were left in the dirt along the way. Across the next days there were gaps in the lines which men raced to defend, but always that same dirty yellow on the horizon, or the reef breaking through a line of blasted trees. Sometimes you could see them coming through the smoke, the shapes of those German boys in black. They were stripping what they could from our fallen boys. And I tried to hold on to what my papa said. My men and I were sent to hold a copse of willow at the salient's deepest point, and I was telling myself, they played with toys too. Yet, when the gas came and I saw their shadows loom, it mattered not at all that they had rode on rocking horses or thrilled at tumbling skittles, not when I saw what their gas had done to Andrew Dunmore's lungs. I fired and fired and fired. I was at the clearing station before I started coughing up blood, and now here I am. Arras is not so far from the line, and yet the streets still stand. Ypres is a ruin, but the ruin is ours, and yet, can it be that my body itself has been conquered? The physician tells me I have my heart. I still have my stronghold, but the salient around me is withered. It is a strange feeling to be weak. But I am alive, Cathy. Isn't that a thing? Cathy lifted her pen to reply, but her fingers had no grip, and her blood was beating so fiercely that she thought she would better run to France and hold him in her arms than write a single word. She was composing herself when she heard Martha's voice at the door, and the girl scrambled in, meaning to lose herself in the hugs and kisses with which every morning began. Cathy embraced her, slipped the journal beneath the bedsheets and thought, "He's alive. He's alive. He's alive." But for how long? Across the next months, the missives flew back and forth between the sleeping emporium and the base hospital at Arras. Caspar's recovery was slow. Cathy charted it in how often he wrote, the steadiness of his hand. Summer had already come, and plans for Emile's wedding were in full swing by the time she saw a change in him. His letters grew long. He was writing in the thick of night, and the passion with which he wrote was evident in the way his pen pressed against the page. Caspar was energized as she had seen him only once before, that summer when he was first learning to make caverns inside his toy boxes. For, stranded in Arras, co-opted by nurses and orderlies to help ferry around patients more critically wounded than himself, Cathy's husband had returned to his old vocation. "I am making toys, Cathy. Toys for the ones who go to sleep at night and will not wake in the morning. Toys for those men I hear crying for their mamas. And might I confess, Cathy, they are the most beautiful toys I have ever built."
Daily the wounded men came through, and daily they were sent away, back to the line in boots, or far from it in boxes. The man beside me died last night. I was holding his hand as he faded. And I think I know now what I did not know before. A secret has been revealed, and finally I understand the true meaning of toys, something my papa learned long before me. When you are young, what you want out of toys is to feel grown up. You play with toys and cast yourself an adult, and imagine life the way it's going to be. Yet when you are grown, that changes. Now, what you want out of toys is to feel young again. You want to be back there, in a place that did not harm nor hurt you, in a pocket of time built out of memory and love. You want things in miniature, where they can better be understood. Battles and houses, picnic baskets and sailing boats too. Boyhood and adulthood. Any toy maker worth his craft has to find a place to sit somewhere between the two. It's only in those borderlands that the very best toys are made. So let me tell you, Kathy, about a new toy I have made. There is a moment, before the end, when a man knows he cannot be saved. I have watched some go to it in a state of quiet awe, but that is not the story of most. Most men feel the encroaching dark and rage against it. But a man can no more fight that battle than light can battle shade. In these hospital beds they hold themselves until they can hold themselves no longer. After that they are men no more. They are like boys with a fever, wanting only to curl up beside Mama, with old blankets on their laps and be sung to and told stories. What better way for a man to go out than the way he came in? With the milk of mother's love. It was my papa who taught me how a toy must speak to a grown man, how it must fill him with the simplicity again of being a child. Children come to the Emporium for adventure, but adults to be reminded that adventure was once possible, that once the world was as filled with magic as the imagination will allow. Emporium toys have always taken us back in time. And as I have lain here in Arras, watching my fellows die around me, I have wondered. Could a toy comfort a man in his final hours? What if he was not here, rotting in a bed in which another man will rot tomorrow, but 20 years ago instead, curled happily in the crook of his mama's arm, knowing that all is good and right in the world? What kind of a toy could be so perfect as to take him back there? The magic so adept that, for brief snatches of time, he might even forget the reality of his life. What if, in his final moments, those memories were manifest around him? Wouldn't that be the perfect toy? She was not sure why the letter made her uneasy. Perhaps only for the idea that Caspar and Death made such common bedfellows. And were it not for the fact that his next missive was so joyous, for first frost had come early to Arras, and Caspar's senses were enlivened by the thought of an emporium in full swing, she might have known it sooner. As Christmas grew close, Caspar's letter showed him, if not his old self, gleeful and fizzling and bursting with ideas, then at least renewed. After he returned to the line and found Douglas Flood, John Horwood and the rest, his humours returned. He wrote no more about his perfect toy, turning instead to questions of Kathy and Martha, and professions of how he missed the shop floor. It was, it seemed, a restorative to be among Emporium friends once again. But Kathy noticed in the way his letters still quivered across the page, in the way the words disintegrated as each sentence moved on, until sometimes they were illegible even after many hours of trying, that all was not right with her husband. The lies had started again. The lies of omission. The lies of, keep your head up and soldier on, forgivable only because this time Caspar was lying to himself as much as he was his wife. Caspar's body had survived the gas, but something else, some other part of him, lay bedraggled and maimed, gasping for air. And still Kathy kept writing, for it was the only thing she could do. Emil Godman and Nina Dean were married on the morning after the snowdrops flowered, bringing the next Emporium winter to its end. Such a sight it was to see Emil in his morning suit and Nina in her bridal gown. They spoke their words and made it formal before a city registrar, but Papa Jack raised a chapel on the shop floor, and into it steamed every shop hand who still survived, along with the ghosts of those who had perished on the way. Emil spoke his vows with a tremble in his voice. Nina, with the sharp authority that was her everyday tone. Martha scattered paper flowers in their wake, while satin butterflies, released from the insectarium, cavorted overhead. "Emil had no best man," Kathy wrote, "for it would have been you, Caspar, to stand at his side and settle his stomach in those few hours before the service, when he knew not how to button a shirt, nor how to fasten a tie, nor even how to put one foot in front of another. You would have laughed to have seen him, but you would have put an arm round him too. Instead, it was me who dusted his morning suit down. He had spent the morning in his workshop, dressed in all his finery, whittling more soldiers for the sweet release it brings him. Me who told him not to put cufflinks into sleeves that were not French cut. Me who told him you would have been proud." She told him it all, about how Nina's family had gaped to see the patchwork Pegasus soaring in the Emporium dome, about how the toast Papa Jack made harked back to his own wedding day and the wife who was lost while he slaved in the frozen east, how Nina, cold, hard Nina, had shed a tear as Emil told the congregation how he had never envisaged a future as perfect as the future he envisaged now. She did not tell him about the fleeting glance Emil gave her, when his speech reached its zenith, for it spoke of indecision, of an instant's hesitation, of an actor at odds with his part. It spoke, she thought, of a stowaway summer long ago, and things that were better left unsaid. She filled pages instead with details of the many tiered cake Mrs. Horning had prepared, the trinkets Martha had already made in anticipation of the cousins to come. She told him all of these things, and sat up through the night waiting for the letter she was certain would come in response. But that was the first time in all of their writing that Caspar never wrote back at all. Childhood's End. Dollis Hill to Papa Jack's Emporium, September 1917. After all this time, Kathy could not get used to riding in a handsome carriage. In her heart, she supposed she would always be a tram girl. But life, like almost everything else, rolled constantly on. This morning, when she stepped out of the carriage, she felt so ostentatious she could not keep her cheeks from turning crimson. It was not right to come to a place like this dressed in finery, nor to have arrived in so cavalier a fashion. Dollis Hill House had been built to a grand specification, and had lost little of that glamour in the century since. A resplendent farmhouse with whitewashed walls, it looked out across the manicured wild of Gladstone Park. This far out of London, the approach was flanked by willows in russet leaf. Some of the convalescents were tending to the estate's empty flowerbeds, and as Kathy began the long approach, they turned to watch her. Makeshift wooden huts, like the barrack she imagined Caspar had once called home, had been erected in a horseshoe along the farmhouse's eastern flank. The sister was there to meet her. Her name was Philomena, and she was the daughter of a local teacher, one of those who had been instrumental in initiating the hospital fund back when the war began. That had been 3 years ago, though the hospital only opened its doors in 1916. "We only had 23 beds at the start," Philomena explained as she took Kathy into a dimly lit reception area, once the farmhouse porch. "Now we have 73, and every one of them taken." "And every one of them needed," thought Kathy.
My sister is a nurse. She's in Dieppe. It's only through her that we knew. It's hard to put in words, but after a little time, my husband stopped writing at all. It had been a slow process. It happened in stages. 1 week between missives, then two, then three and four. Once his letters had been long and florid, then they were short, perfunctory things. It got so that he said almost nothing of his days, and that was when Kathy knew for certain that he was in some kind of hell, trapped there, alone, all of the Emporium hands gone from this world, and Casper left as officer of a group of young boys, some so young they must still have thrilled at trips to the Emporium each Christmas. She had told him once that he must never lie to her again, so instead he drew within himself. Wrote letters with silly, nonsensical verses for Martha, or wrote none at all. 3 summer months had passed without a word, when the letter arrived on the Emporium doorstep. It was Martha who had brought it to her, sobbing even before the envelope opened. Kathy had wanted to sob too, for a letter from Arras certainly meant her husband's death. Instead, she had found a hand she had almost forgotten, the delicately practiced hand of her sister. "Kathy, forgive the brusqueness of this note, but I write on a matter most unexpected and no less urgent. As you know, I have been stationed in Dieppe these past months. 2 months ago I made an exchange with a nurse close to the line, whose nerves demanded she be relieved from the front. In this capacity I have been nursing in the base hospital in Arras. The work is relentless, the hours long, and perhaps if it was not this way I would have known sooner. But there is a face here you would know well. He awoke from his injuries 1 week past. I believe he even recognises who I am. Kathy, you must prepare yourself. He has suffered. But... Sister Philomena was disappearing into the twilight of the hospital interior. Coming out of herself, Kathy hurried after. Tell me, have you come far? London. The sister paused, as if the information did not tally with what she had been told. Please forgive me, Kathy explained. We only discovered my husband was here 3 days ago. My sister wrote that he would be repatriated to England, but that was all. One of the other convalescents penned us a letter when he arrived here, but it took some time to find us. The envelope had said Emporium, and nothing more. The manic scrawl of a soldier come back from Grasse, where, or so he professed, his body had been made an offering to the fire. I see, Sister Philomena said, and Kathy was grateful when they drew to a halt outside the door of what had once been the farmhouse study. The doctor will see you now. Through the door sat a physician who Philomena introduced as Norrell. He was a small man, and when Kathy stepped into the study, he was buried in reams of papers. After studiously finishing the final leaf, he looked up and said, "Take a seat, Mrs. Godman. I should like to see my husband, if it pleases. And I shall take you to him soon. Lieutenant Godman isn't going far. But first there are things we ought to discuss. Please, Mrs. Godman, if the lieutenant is to return home with you this day, and he's professed no resistance to the idea, it's important that you understand." What was there to understand? Casper was coming back to the place he belonged. Papa Jack's Emporium had been waiting for him for 3 long years. The look on Norrell's face compelled her to sit. "When did you last see Lieutenant Godman, Mrs. Godman?" How she wished they would stop calling him that, Lieutenant Godman, as if he was anything other than the wild-haired boy who had secreted her in the Wendy house all summer long. Anything other than the man who had spent Midwinter's Eve of 5 years past painfully recreating a lost bear in spider silk and fur, so that Martha would not miss it on her pillow when she awoke. "I know about his injuries," she said, suddenly strident, "but I am his wife. You'll think it ought to matter, but you don't know me, and you don't know my husband." Dr. Norrell gave a simpering look that seemed to say, "They all think that in the beginning." But then he said, "Lieutenant Godman's injuries were not insignificant.
Yet his body has borne them well. He'll walk again, I'm certain of that. No, Mrs. Godman, what I want to talk about are the injuries we do not see. For a moment he was silent. This is a convalescent hospital, Mrs. Godman. It is not a hospice. It is my duty to repair our men and return them to the front, where they are needed most. I am taught to watch for malingerers, for confidence men, for men of ill honour. But not every wound is one you can stitch together or cut away, and not every man who isn't fit to return is a malingerer. I am speaking, as you must know, about maladies of the heart and of the head. My husband isn't mad, Dr. Norrell. Madness is relative. Do you know in Ypres they called your husband the Godman? The Godman, on account of the things he did that put him in harm's way. His record demonstrates him a ruthlessly efficient leader. He's been promoted and decorated. The boys in his platoon look up to him enormously. And the same cannot be said for many of the NCOs whose paths have crossed mine. And yet, Mrs. Godman, your husband has not breathed a word since the day he arrived. There has been no crack through which I can shine a light to better understand what goes on behind his eyes. Mrs. Godman, you may not want to hear what I have to say next, but it's important that you do. Your husband was dragged from the mire by two of his men. By the time they reached the field station, it had been 18 hours since the explosion that felled him. He had spent every one of those hours with his head buried in the cavity of his second lieutenant's chest. When the field ambulance reached him, they believed him to be dead. The Godman, they said, dead and gone. And yet he awoke, in the hospital behind the front line. By some miracle, his wounds were not infected. He is still there, behind his eyes, Mrs. Godman. But there has been no way in. Most of my colleagues would tell you that silence settles the mind, that the lieutenant is doing everything he can to return to himself. But there is another school of thought, and it is my sincere belief that, for maladies like your husband's, the only cure is in the talking. Again he stopped. Do you understand my meaning, Mrs. Godman? Your husband cannot be cured if he remains hidden inside his own head. What you're saying, said Kathy, is that my husband is here, and yet he is not. The doctor laid down his papers. Perhaps it is time that you saw the lieutenant for yourself. Casper was classified as a cot case, and as such was in the ground floor ward, among the other bedridden and fresh amputees. Sister Philomena was emerging from the room as they arrived. Inside, makeshift curtain rails divided the beds, and there, propped up in bed with his head hanging down, was the man Kathy had loved for so many years. Lieutenant Godman, the Godman, her Casper. He was old. That was the thing that struck her. She could see the bones of his cheeks. They gave him the look of a sculpture, though without any of a sculpture's classical poise. Upon his lap sat a wooden box, carved with the fractures of 1,000 snowflakes, and on its top a varnished plate spun at the same pace as the crank handle Casper's hand was turning. On the plate danced two circus acrobats, mahogany mice in braces and long pantaloons. The melody from the contraption inside was lilting and sad, a nursery rhyme as played by a harpist of great renown. It slowed and sped up according to the whim of Casper's hand. "Did he make that thing?" Kathy whispered. "Sister," called Dr. Norrell, and at his command Sister Philomena returned to the room. "The music box, did the lieutenant—" "It was in pieces, and part of his packs," she explained. "The first days he was here he rebuilt it out of every last splinter. Sometimes he lends it to the other men.
They're besotted with it, and it's the queerest thing. Whenever Lieutenant Godman's without it, he comes out of himself. He gets out of bed, he starts pacing, he prowls. I do believe he has an attachment. Kathy took 3 great strides into the ward. Some of the other soldiers revolved to face her, but Casper, her poor, beautiful Casper, did not flinch. His eyes saw only the twirling mice. His ears heard only that sweet, sad refrain. "Bring me a cane," she said. "I've a carriage waiting outside. Dr. Nora, my husband, is coming home." The spyglass was one of Martha's most treasured possessions. Her papa, not her blood papa, who she understood in the storybook kind of way she understood these things to have perished in the Aegean, had made it for her. It had an ivory handle in a pearlescent design, and if you pressed one eye to the glass, you could watch everything that was happening through its sister piece, hidden out on Iron Duke Mews. That was how she knew of her mother's return, even before the Emporium doors opened. As soon as the spyglass revealed the handsome carriage approaching, she scrambled for the dirigible tethered between the paper trees. She was in the stern, preparing to toss ballast over the side, when Sirius lolloped out of the trees and set up his thin cotton whimpers. "Oh, come on, then," she said with a dramatic roll of her eyes. And Sirius, so elated to be included, turned top over tail as she hauled him aboard. Now that they were ready, she threw the last of the sandbags to the Emporium floor, heaved up the tether, and clung on as the dirigible rocketed skywards. Up they went, up and further up, up past the Wendy House roof, up past the paper branches, and finally through the canopy, into the Emporium dome. Martha had flown this route before, but now came the most perilous part. Timing was key. Above her, the Cloud Castle was hoving into view. When it was almost upon them, she reached out for the rope dangling from its drawbridge. By using her body as an anchor, she slowed the dirigible's rise and heaved it to a mooring by the drawbridge winch. Then, with burning arms and a pride in a job well done, she helped Sirius clamber over the side. Down below, where the empty aisles were draped in dust sheets, the Emporium doors were opening up. The first figure who came through she knew to be her mother, both because of the ostentatiousness of her hat, Martha rolled her eyes, and the day bag hanging over her shoulder. That bag, she knew, had been a gift from her papa. The girl had hidden inside it once, just to see how deep down it could go. The figure who came next was hunched over, dwarfed by the grey greatcoat he wore. In one of his hands he held a cane, which he seemed to be using as a third leg, and he moved with mortifying slowness. "What do you think?" Martha whispered. "Is it him?" Sirius's tail had exploded in delight. "It is!" she exclaimed. "Papa! Papa, up here!" It was her mother's face that looked up. Her papa seemed not to have heard. Surely he couldn't have forgotten the days and nights they'd camped up here, the stories he'd told her, the games they'd played across the Cloud Castle floor. It was here he'd told her about the birth of Sirius, or at least the first day he'd been wound up, the day he met her mother, the time he'd grown a labyrinth out of his paper trees and got trapped inside it for 6 days and 7 nights, eating only papier-mâché fruit to survive. She had doubted the veracity of that last story, but she'd loved it all the same. From this distance it was difficult to tell, but it seemed that her mother was glaring. Possibly she was instructing her to stay away, but since she couldn't be sure, she felt no great desire to obey. With one hand still restraining Sirius, she skirted around the castle walls to return to the dirigible. A few more sandbags heaved aboard would send her crashing back through the paper trees. Down, down, down they came. So filled by thoughts of reaching her papa was she, and so distracted by the delirious twirling of the patchwork dog that she misjudged the landing. The dirigible came down hard, struck the roots of a paper oak, and listed wildly. By the time Martha had picked herself up and checked Sirius for tears to his fabric, the shop floor was empty again. Too late. Her mother had taken her papa into the quarters above. Martha hesitated before following. All of her excitement had evaporated, and in its wake were only nerves. She stamped her foot. It was not fair.